on Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight is called to order. We have the minutes from the February 12th hearing. Are there any corrections to the minutes as provided? Senator Pappas, you don't have the minutes?
I didn't look in my folder. I got him.
I'll move the minutes, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzold moves approval of the minutes of the hearing of February 12th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. We have Senate File 15. It's our first bill. Senator Pretner-Solon. Members, one of the responsibilities of this committee is to look at bills that establish or change a commission, a legislative commission, a task force, an advisory group, or whatever. I provided members on the floor today with a memo that is in your packets. I provided it to all members. That is in your packets that sets up some guidelines on advisory groups of one kind or the other. And I realize, Senator Pretner-Solon, that you didn't get these until today, but there are some issues that need to be addressed in your bill that
amendment
task force that you will want to change. And I don't see Mr.
Fodder.
I don't see Senate counsel here, or at least see Mr. Watson. I don't see Mr. Bodden.
Madam Chair, we did actually review your recommendations.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yes, and we have responded to those, and we do have two amendments, hopefully, that will address that.
Oh, great. We just don't have the person who would have them here. But why don't you explain what the task force is? And Senator Pretner-Solon, our job is not to make any kind of judgments, as far as we can keep from doing that, on the policy that is in your bill. Our job, that job belongs to the Health and Human Services Committee. Our job is to look at the task force that you established. Here he comes.
So, Madam Chair, you don't want me to address the bill itself?
No, just talk to us about how the task force is going to be supporting the goal of the bill.
Okay. Madam Chair, the task force would provide recommendations on a health care delivery system that contains cost, is based on health outcomes, increases access to and utilization of services, reduces health disparities, and integrates best practices. And the task force is included in this legislation to study some of the difficult questions and problems that we need to grapple with as we implement broad health care reform in the Children's Health Security Act. The task force is required to present its recommendations to the Legislative Commission on Health Care Access by January 15, 2009. And I do have an amendment to Section 15, which deals with the composition of the task force. And the amendment changes, that would be...
Do you have it written, Senator Pretner-Solon?
That would be A5, the A5 amendment.
Senator Pretner-Solon, the final change in your amendment is due to arrive any moment now.
Okay.
So why don't you explain what you're going to propose to change, and then I do have some questions about that, and we'll see whether my questions are answered in the explanation of your amendment, and we'll act on it when we get it.
Basically, Madam Chair, the A5 amendment, which I think you do have, unless it's been incorporated in another amendment.
Mr. Bodden indicates that there's another change was requested, not by me, but by
the chair and convening the task force.
Relating to the chair and convening it and so forth.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm just not sure, is that, are we to adopt both, or did you create one amendment that takes care of both issues?
He incorporated it so that we would just have one amendment. But you can, why don't you just tell us how you're going to change it?
Okay, well, basically what we're going to do is change the number of legislative members from each body from 5 to 6, and we're going to add 6 non-legislative stakeholders as non-voting members. Then...
And Senator Brittany-Solon, who is going to appoint the public members?
Well, that is identified in the bill, in the amendment.
No, just tell us.
Mostly it's the groups that these members represent. So I can't remember. Does Carol remember?
Here it is.
Here it comes.
Oh, here it is. It would be the American Academy of Pediatrics, Minnesota Nurses Association, the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, Minnesota Children's Platform Coalition, Minnesota Universal Healthcare Coalition, the Minnesota Business Partnership. Would each appoint one non-voting member?
So, Senator Brittany-Solon, how would the non-voting public members get their appointments?
Madam Chair,
we just say that there's a representative from the Minnesota Business Partnership, for example, but how is that person going to be appointed?
They would be appointed by their organization.
Okay, I think we need to state that. And I'm not trying to get in the way of this task force. I'm trying to make sure that when you really want it to start, it just starts smoothly and operates. So I think that at one point, I think we could say, you know, chosen by Mr. Bodden, help me here. How should they?
Madam Chair and members, I think on, I believe it's page 1, line 12 of the amendment, you could delete from and simply insert selected by.
Yes.
And you might want to add after following organization, insert organizations.
I'll move that.
We actually don't have the amendment in front of us. So, Senator Marty, would you move the amendment? And this is not an author's amendment, so this would just be an amendment to the amendment. So the non-voting member, it would read then, the non-voting members are one representative selected by the following organizations. Senator Brittany-Solon, is that agreeable?
Yeah, so you're deleting each of the following also?
Yes.
That's fine with me, Madam Chair.
I think you wanted to read. Madam Chair, I think it would be best if it read one representative selected by each of the following.
By each of the following organizations. Then in your original bill, I was curious about when you say someone, five members of the House of Representatives and Senate appointed under the rules of the House and the Senate, what does that mean? And do our task force, are the rules governing the appointment by the Senate in the rules? And if not, I don't think they are.
You just changed it.
And I wonder if you might want to change that to appointed 6 members of the House of Representatives appointed 6 members of the House of Representatives, of whom, anyway, the idea would be that the majority party members would be appointed by the Speaker and the minority party members would be appointed by the minority leader. We don't have, the permanent rules of the Senate, and I don't know about the House, but the permanent rules of the Senate do not give the subcommittee on committees, I don't believe, that authority, unless you state it in the bill, because sometimes members are appointed through the authority of the majority leader. Sometimes the president of the Senate does it. So saying according to the rules would end up having this task force ready to go and no way to appoint them because it's not there.
Madam Chair, the intention was that the majority leader would appoint the majority members and the minority leader would appoint the minority leaders. But I would defer to Mr. Bodern as
Mr.
He did
Mr. Bodern, could
draft
you,
our legislation.
Or tell me if I'm wrong.
Madam Chair, I'm looking at the Senate rules as they were published last year. I'm not sure if this rule was amended. I don't think so. Rule 11.2 says that unless otherwise provided, the subcommittee on committees shall appoint all members of commissions or other bodies authorized to be appointed by the Senate and report the amendment, the appointments to the Senate. I think that would.
Does that work for the House too, then?
I don't know that. I can check that right now.
Then what you would be asking then, just so we know that, is that it would be the subcommittee on committees rather than the majority leader and the minority leader, so that the subcommittee on committees, which is controlled by the majority party, would be appointing the minority members as well. Is that what you want?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. And we'll check on the and thank you, Mr. Bodern. I didn't realize that. But we'll see whether the rules of the House do the same thing. You state who the chair is or the chairs?
It does in the Second Amendment, Madam Chair, which we haven't in front of us at this time yet.
Paragraph D?
Yes.
Okay, I'm just seeing this now for the first time, too. So we ask that the task force members be appointed by September 1 and the subcommittee on committees in the Senate would designate a chair or a co-chair. The House member would be convene and chair the first meeting, and then they alternate. Correct? That's in terms of running the meetings.
That was the intention. I haven't seen the amendment yet.
Oh, I thought it was handed to you.
No, I have five, but I don't have the other amendment.
Madam Chair and Senator Solon, I apologize. I didn't have this renumbered, so they unfortunately each have the same number, but you can tell quite easily looking at them. The second one is a lengthier amendment. And I will jump in and read the House rule that pertains to committee appointments.
Okay.
I think it covers this situation. House Rule 6.03 provides that upon the convening of the biennial session, the Speaker must notify the members of the House of each board or commission to which a member of the House may be appointed by the Speaker.
Okay.
I'm not sure that would apply directly here. The Speaker must request advice from the Minority Leader on those appointments. So it could be we want to specify that the Speaker of the House shall have and the Minority Leader shall have the respective appointing authority.
Senator Pretnasolo, is that what you would like, that the minority members in the House, since the rule is not specific, would be appointed by the minority leader?
Madam Chair, that was our intention, and I'm open to whatever language accomplishes that.
Okay, Mr. Bodern is going to work on that. The rest of, would you explain the rest of the task force then? What they're to do and when. You've got their duties in here, and that's one of the things we had wanted people to look at.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
As Mr. Bodern is working on that, did I understand that the Subcommittee on Rules is going to do the appointing in the Senate? And is that procedure spelled out so that the minority leader also has input into that?
That was the point I was making. The rules of the Senate that I looked through the statute. I didn't look through the rules, so I did think that was a strange phrase there. We'll know better from now on. state that the subcommittee on committees makes appointments to all commissions, et cetera. And I just made the flat out statement, the subcommittee on committees is controlled by the majority party. So if you wanted, and it's certainly been a, I don't think that there have been appointments made that where the majority members of the subcommittee on committees haven't, for the most part, acceded to the wishes of the minority leader in the appointments to these commissions, et cetera. But if you really want that authority to rest with the minority leader, then you have to state it.
Madam Chair, and I'm thinking that we probably should. Tradition has it that they usually do take the advice of the minority leader, but it has had a few exceptions on occasion, and much to the chagrin of the minority. Mm-hmm. And I think that as long as we're putting that language in for the House, that it should be comparable for the Senate.
So you would suggest that the and this is the first bill we've had like this, Senator Prentice-Solins, so just bear with us, that the language for the Senate would read the subcommittee on committees for the majority member party, the majority party members, but the minority leader would choose the minority party members.
Correct.
And then in the House, it would be the Speaker and the minority leader, because the Speaker in the House and the majority leader in the Senate have different roles.
Correct.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
That was entirely our intention. So whatever language that could be adopted that provides that the whoever the majority person leader is in the House and the Senate appoint the majority members, and whoever the minority leader is in the House and the Senate appoint the
okay, that's the alternative. And that might be the simplest thing for getting this here. But Senator Betzel?
Well, I'm sure that however we word it, the House – however, whatever process they go through, they're going to word the bill however they want to get there. For the Senate, historically, we've had the subcommittee on committees make the appointments. We have had things in recent years, I think, where we've said the majority leader appoints, the minority leader appoints.
Right.
Ultimately, I think this bill has to – it'll go to finance because of the appropriation. I think it also has to go to the Rules Committee because they do require that if we're going to be appointing legislators,
yes,
the Rules Committee needs
that.
To see it. I have this funny feeling that the Rules Committee may just change it to be the Subcommittee on Committees. The Senate rules were changed this year to simply to have six members because it had been five.
Right.
And actually, Senator Polgemiller wanted it to be six because that would increase the number of minority members on the Subcommittee on Committees. But I believe that his intention is to have that Subcommittee on Committees work. Frankly, don't think he wants to take the responsibility for making these decisions. He wants that subcommittee and committees to do that. So we can say majority, minority leader. I just have a hunch
that
the Rules Committee
is going
to change it.
I don't believe that committee, however, yeah. In terms of protecting the rights of the minority is, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe it's 3-3.
No, it'll be 4-2.
Right. So
it'll be 4-2. But as I say,
point is well taken.
my point is that we may say the majority leader makes appointments and the minority leader makes appointments in the Senate. I just have this funny feeling that when this bill gets to the Rules Committee, they may change it to the Subcommittee on Committees.
And they certainly are free to do that, but we want to do the work of this committee and this committee and express what we think, along with the author, is the best way to go. Senator Prettner-Solon.
And Madam Chair, I maybe missed Senator Roebling's comments, but our intention was never to split it equally. It was proportionately.
Madam Chair, and I wasn't asking for that. I just want the minority leader to have the ability to appoint the minority members.
Right. No, I understand that.
Okay.
And I support that that position. So we need a little bit of work here on the language. But I think otherwise your amendment addresses the guidelines that I'm aware of that apply to setting up this this task force, that there's a chair mentioned, that there's a time to convene it, there's a request of when the members have to be appointed, what the duties are, and what the and how the group is to operate. And I appreciate your working on this in such short notice. Mr. Bodern, are we ready for the amendment?
Madam Chair, I think I can work on the House language, and then I wasn't clear. Is your intention to leave the Senate appointments alone, or do you want to change that to reflect appointment by a majority leader and appointment by the minority leader?
I support having the minority leader appoint the minority members in the Senate.
Okay, I think I can take care of that then. What I'll do is read the way the language will read when we're done with the page and line amendments, just so you have a clear understanding of that. On beginning on page 1, line 7, that clause would read, 6 members of the House of Representatives, comma, of whom 4 members must be appointed by the Speaker of the House, and 2 members must be appointed by the minority leader. Then clause 2 would read, 6 members of the Senate, comma, of whom 4 members must be appointed by the majority leader, and 2 members appointed by the minority leader. Then we'd also have to change the language in paragraph D, and I think that would specify on page 1, line 20, you delete appointing authorities in clauses 1 and 2 and specify the, and I presume this is what the committee would wish to do, the majority leader of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. I suppose you could also say the subcommittee on committees of the Rules Committee of the Senate and the Speaker of the House. That would be
well. If we're changing it above to majority leader, we should have the majority leader in the Senate appoint the designate the chair from the Senate.
Okay.
Just for consistency, and then if the Rules Committee doesn't like that approach, even though that's been used a number of times in the past, they'll at least have a consistent approach to doing that. Does everybody understand the language that was read and how this would change the A5 amendment? Senator Marty, you'll incorporate that in the A5 amendment, so we just need to take one vote. Is there any questions or comments on the change on this amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bodern.
I apologize. There's one small addition that I didn't catch until now. On page 1, line 21, we need to change the reference there from under clause 1 to the Speaker of the House. And on page 1, line 22, delete under clause 2 and insert by the majority leader of the Senate.
Senator Marty, would you move that amendment? Is that clear to everyone? Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 15 before us as amended. Is there anyone who wishes to testify on Senate File 15, either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Senator Prettner-Solem.
Madam Chair, yes, Yvonne Harvey is here. Buddy Robinson was going to show up but was unable to be here. You also asked me to identify talk about the responsibilities of the committee. I'm not sure if you want me to say anything further about that.
Maybe just a brief.
Okay.
Madam Chair. But your witness can join you.
Come on, Yvonne. Basically, Madam Chair, the responsibilities of this task force would be, the bill really speaks to universal health care for children, and we're trying to do it in a cost-effective way that focuses on early intervention, prevention, and best practices. So it asks the task force to focus on those 4 issues and to come up with, to make recommendations as regards how to implement it based on those 4 recommendations.
And Senator Prettner-Solem, you have those recommendations going to the Legislative Commission on Healthcare Access.
Correct.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Yvonne Harvey, and I'm from Duluth, Minnesota.
go ahead. I'm a board member of the Greater Minnesota Healthcare Coalition, and our organization has several thousand members throughout the state, and we have over 30 years of experience in state healthcare policy. I'm also the executive vice president of the Minnesota Citizens Federation Northeast. We are here today to express our strong support for Senate File 15. We ultimately want to see the state continue to look into universal coverage for everyone, yet we realize that it is reasonable to start by first covering all children. We are strongly in support of the section which creates a legislative task force on children's health care delivery. The task force will examine health care reform and cost containment measures, as well as how to improve access. This is exactly what is needed. If universal coverage for children is not done as economically and efficiently as possible, then it won't happen for adults, because the money just won't be there. The new plan in Massachusetts will not work because it does not address the huge administrative waste caused by the private insurance and HMO sectors. The legislature needs to have a lot of light shed on these issues. I doubt that many legislators know that in the southwest part of the state, the Prime West county-based purchasing system increased the number of participating dentists from 4 to 32 in the 3 years after taking operations of the state's low-income programs away from the HMOs. How did they do this? They did it by paying dentists up to 140% of the DHS standard rate. How could they afford that? Simply by keeping administrative costs to half or less than the HMO's administrative cost. It would be very useful for the legislative task force to take testimony from county-based purchasers. This raises another problem that the legislative task force should address. In order to accurately access the economic efficiency level of the HMOs, you have to pass their Enron-style bookkeeping, in which they claim their administrative costs are much less than what they actually are. At the hearing on Senate File 15 on January 31st, Catherine Commit of the Council of HMOs urged that the senators ask state agency people to come in and vouch for the HMOs' finances. However, Senator Lori reported that those same agency people, when questioned, could not offer any confidence in the HMO's numbers. For this reason, it would be wise for the new legislative task force to ask for testimony from the Attorney General's office, which is the only entity that has performed independent external audits of the HMO books. Let me repeat, the only entity that has performed truly independent external audits of the HMO books. In conclusion, there is a lot of important information out there on cost containment, which the legislature usually doesn't hear. The new legislative task force is a good way for that information to be heard. My organizations both would be very willing to appear before the task force and share what we have accumulated over the years. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hardy. Are there questions for her or for Senator Brettner Solon? Is there Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for Senator Brettner Solon. I'm just wondering, and this isn't related necessarily to the task force, but I'm wondering on page 2, line 26 and 27, when it says that signing an affidavit declaring the applicant currently resides in the state and intends to reside in the state permanently, could someone who is not of legal status sign that affidavit?
Senator Brettner Solon, would you give us your cite again, Senator Roebling?
It's page 2, lines 26 and 27.
And Madam Chair, Senator Roebling.
Senator Brettner Solon.
The question was whether or not somebody not of legal status would be eligible. They would be. They would be eligible.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling?
Can they legally sign something saying they intend to stay in the state permanently if they're not eligible to stay in the state permanently?
Senator Brenner-Solon.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll have to look at this, and maybe I can get some advice here. But I think that residents of the states are treated differently than those who are not legal residents. But
this is a little bit beyond the purview of this committee, but we'll let Senator Brenner-Solon respond, and then we'll move to a vote.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Carol Spector, and I'm the Legislative and Advocacy Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Senator Roebling, in answer to your question, it's actually a question I would have to ask DHS. I know that the residency requirements are meant to mirror the current public programs residency requirements. That's a separate question, I think, than whether or not undocumented or people here, or the legal status of their being in the state, if, whether or not they're eligible.
Okay. Madam Chair, I do think that's important, and I don't know which committee would actually handle state residency. It sounds like a good job for us, but I don't know where else it would go. But I think it's a question that is very important to this issue, actually, and will determine whether or not the kind of support you'll get for it, I think. So I wish
Spector,
I knew the answer.
Ms. Spector, did you say that this is that the residency requirement is similar to language that controls participation by children in other state programs?
Yes.
So this is not,
Madam Chair.
This is not carving out new law giving benefits to children who don't already qualify for them, regardless of their immigration status. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Correct, Madam Chair.
And that might be something, Senator, I would agree with Senator Roebling, that might be something, Senator Brenner-Solon, that you'll want to emphasize as you go along further. This is not new law, and it's not a new benefit. It is reflecting what is in the current statutes. Anything else from members? Mr. Griffin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I'm here today on behalf of UCARE Minnesota, which is one of the health plans, and I hadn't intended to testify today, but Ms. Hardy's testimony brings me to the table. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are supportive of the intent of Senator Brenner-Solon in trying to pass Senate File 15. We think the idea of trying to provide more health care coverage to people is exactly what the state ought to be engaged in doing this legislative session. However, some of the information that she is giving you is not correct, and I can't sit in the audience and listen to it without trying to make some of those corrections. We will respond in detailed writing, Madam Chair, to the allegations that were made about our administrative expenses and our disagreements with what the previous Attorney General did in his study. Suffice it to say that we don't think it's copacetic to add our administrative expenses to those of the providers and the hospitals in the community and suggest that that's the administrative cost of the health plan. We just don't think that's correct. Secondly, the piece that was talked about briefly about the number of dentists that were brought into the program, in those areas, the health plans were not providing services under the prepaid medical assistance program, so it's impossible to say that access was changed when the health plans were booted out. We were not booted out of that area. Madam Chair, I know that there are a lot of issues around health care, and these are very difficult issues. The solutions are not going to be easy for any of you, but we hope that the information that we deal with when we try to make these decisions is truthful, and we will work with you to try and bring that to the attention of the committee when we can. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin.
Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair. Anyone?
Madam Chair.
Pickerman.
I represent a district that's got a lot of minorities moving into the southern part of the state. I believe those little children, if they're born in the state, they're automatically citizens. Am I right?
That's correct, Senator Rickman.
And, you know, we squander money all over this place, but I certainly wouldn't want some migrant worker, some little kid that couldn't get insurance. I think that's against the principles that I live with. So take a look at that and see how it is. But they're here. They're going to be here to stay, and we want more of them to be here.
We look forward to the good work of this task force and for an honest exchange of views and information, Mr. Griffin. Thank you for coming forward. Is there any other testimony on this bill? Senator Marty?
I'll move the bill.
Senator Marty moves that Senate file 15 as amended be recommended to pass.
Finance.
And refer to the Rules Committee. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Pretner-Solon. Senator Wieger.
Was this to rules?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, but I would think finance.
Madam Chair, may Myra Norfield join me?
Of course.
It might be part of an omnibus bill, though.
If a bill does have legislative members that are added to it, it will be our practice to send it to rules, and then the Rules Committee can send the bill to finance. What I do want to make sure that the Rules Committee reviews these new groups and not have the bill go to finance and then never leave there. So that's what our process will be. Senator Wieger, we have we have a subcommittee report here. Senator Larson?
Yes, move adoption of the I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Got me a little I would make the appropriate motion, Madam Chair.
I see. Senator Larson moves that the subcommittee report on Senate File 81 be adopted. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it, and the motion prevails. Senator Wieger, we had a very full hearing on this bill in the Elections Subcommittee. We will take some brief additional testimony in front of the full committee, but we've had a full hearing on this bill.
Okay. Madam Chair, thank you for that advice, and committee members and to Subcommittee Chair Larson, we appreciate the thoughtful consideration. Senate File 81, as amended, calls for an elected Metro Council. As you know, the Council was created by the legislature in 1967. It is our regional form of government. It has taxation power. It has a significant amount of bonded indebtedness, and the expenditures are significant as well. I don't have a complaint with the Metropolitan Council itself. To the contrary, I'm a strong proponent and a former member of the Council. Rather, I would like to see the Council strengthened by having it directly accountable to the public, and that's the basic issue for why we should have an elected Council. As it is now, it's a gubernatorial appointment, and this issue has been discussed at least twice on the Senate floor, where it was a veto most recently 10 years ago that prevented it from becoming an elected body. And it's before you again, whether it was a Republican governor or a Democratic governor, I believe the people should decide. Many good recommendations were made there in your summary report. And Madam Chair, I would like former Senator Myra Norfield to offer a few comments. There is a thoughtful handout, which has actually been updated since the last subcommittee hearing, as you would expect from Professor Norfield. We have others in the audience that are available, the Sierra Club, ISAIAH, Alliance for Metropolitan Stability. But with your permission, I'd like to have Senator Norfield address the committee.
Professor Norfield, you did testify at the subcommittee extensively. If your remarks could be brief and in summary, we do not need to hear your full testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will be brief. I have just updated the materials that I brought. I testify on behalf, Madam Chair, of electing the Metropolitan Council. This was an effort when I was in the legislature many years ago, as I supported with Governor and I, Governor Plenty, when he was then a member of the legislature. He and I authored this for four terms together. The Metropolitan Council, just to summarize the testimony that I have, it's got a budget of $630 million a year. It is the third largest unit of government in the state. It has more bonded debt than any other unit of government besides the City of Minneapolis and the Hennepin County. It's a very significant entity, and entities that are this large and that are multi-purpose public authorities in the United States, as a general principle, are elected bodies. It relates to the principle of taxation and representation. There isn't a precedent for a body that is this large and this powerful that I'm aware of that's unelected. The federal statute that urges the creation of the Metropolitan Council that requires metropolitan areas of more than 50,000 to have metropolitan planning agencies suggests that they should be elected. They should be composed of elected officials. Our particular Metro Council, which is appointed, has to have a rider every several years from the federal government so that it isn't elected. It's of the metropolitan planning organizations in the country, of which there are more than 150. It's the only one that I'm aware of that is not composed of elected officials. But this Metropolitan Council that we have is much more significant than normal metropolitan planning organizations. It lays out a metropolitan land use plan, a metropolitan sewer plan. It is a multi-purpose public authority that's vastly more significant and has vastly more discretionary power than other regional councils. And I'd be happy to answer questions.
Are there comments or questions for, at this point, Senator Wicker or Professor Orfield? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Wicker, Professor Orfield, I'm concerned about projects that are currently in the works that the Met Council is involved in. For example, the Central Corridor is very important to me and important to legislators in the East Metro area as well as Minneapolis. And what kind of an impact could changing the governance structure have on getting federal funding for that project?
Madam Chair.
Professor Orfield.
And Senator Pappas. The federal statute that requires regional areas of over 50,000 people to have a metropolitan planning organization, as a provision of that statute, it says that the members should be elected officials. Now, in most parts of the country, this means that they are city council members or county commissioners that are appointed by the governor and or approved by the legislature. This is the norm. But the federal statute suggests, it requires that they be elected officials. And I'm aware that this is the only regional planning agency in the country that has a directly appointed metropolitan planning organization, and that is only allowed to occur by a special rider that it has to be passed at the federal level to exempt our metropolitan planning organization from that normal requirement. So I believe that that's the norm, that elected officials fulfill this function. Generally, it's other elected officials, county commissioners, mayors, and other kinds of officials that are appointed to this. But I, there's no reading that I have of the federal law that would, it would seem to me that it would move it much closer into line with the requirements for metropolitan planning organizations, not away from it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I think that it's going to be important before we pass this that we get, because I know for Senator Wicker, the Central Corridor is also very important, that we get some clarity, because if you have a, if you have kind of normal turnover of a group, usually it's staggered, and you don't have the whole, and this is going to be a wholesale turnover of a group, and if the federal government is going to, or the federal administrators is going to require this new council to reaffirm decisions that the previous council made and not, that could delay the you know, the funding and implementation of the Central Corridor. And so I just want to, I just think we have to be pretty cautious here. We have to be careful. I was trying to call Representative Congresswoman Betty McCollum's office, and they're closed for President's Day.
Right.
We're the only ones who are open today. But, Senator Wicker, I just hope if this bill passes out of this committee that we really need to be very careful here.
Adam.
And Senator Pappas and Senator Wicker, there are other committees that we learned just prior to the convening of this committee that want to see this bill. So there will be opportunity for some oversight in other jurisdictions. In particular, the Transportation Committee asked to see this bill. So those kinds of questions could certainly be raised there with regard to the work of the Met Council. questions for Professor Orfield or Senator Wicker? Senator Vickerman.
Well, Madam Chair, coming from clear down the southwestern part of Minnesota, this kind of puts me into a situation, you know, I could vote for it, I could vote against it. It makes it a little hard when it's, you know, it's really just a metropolitan issue. And I know we're supposed to represent the whole state, so I need to know a little bit more about it. And I looked at the names of the people on here, and I have great respect for them on the bill. So I could go either way on this issue, but I want to do the right thing. So I hope this goes to different committees so that they can fine-tune it.
It will be. It has been. If this committee acts favorably on it, it has been requested, first of all, by the Committee on Transportation, and then I understand that actually the Environment Committee is also considering asking for it because of the policy areas that the Metropolitan Council takes action on. And I think that when I first heard that, I thought, well, why do they want to see it? But I think that the concerns, quite frankly, that Senator Pappas just raised speaks to that very well. Senator Wicker, did you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, we look forward to discussion on issues. We are not changing the authority of the council, though some of you did have suggestions on that. It's on the election, but to the extent policy committees would like to talk about potential impact or perceived, we look forward to it.
Senator Roebling, and then we do want to get on to other testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am a member representing the metro area and not a supporter of an elected Met Council. I'll just lay that out right away. But Senator Orfield, you commented that most entities have elected officials appointed to these positions. And I am wondering why we didn't pursue that route if we want to handle this differently than we have in the past. Why aren't we looking for county commissioners and mayors and people like that? And why would we go to a whole new elected level of officials and have what I perceive will be end up being very partisan political races with people who have to somewhat be beholden to their supporters. And I don't feel comfortable with that. I think a planning agency like the Met Council should be as nonpartisan as possible. There's no way we can prevent partisanship from coming into these elections because these people are going to be running in what is comparable to almost three Senate districts. Those are big seats, and at least two and a half. And, you know, to raise the money and to get the volunteers for an election like that, it'll end up being partisan. It'll be parties supporting the candidates. And I really have a problem with it, and I just don't understand why aren't we considering appointments of elected officials instead?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I think that these are really important concerns. And when I was authoring this bill, when I was a member of the legislature with Representative Pawlenty, I think that these were things that we debated and thought about a lot. And I think we come to the same resolution that American legislatures usually do with very significant local authorities that tax large amounts and spend a great deal. When bodies have multi-purpose, very broad discretionary authority and have significant taxing powers, it's important that they be accountable directly to voters. There's not a you could say the same thing about Hennepin County. You could say the same thing about all the significant counties or any of them. You could say that if they – or the legislature for that matter. You could say that they have become partisan and they are they spend too much time raising money and they aren't as efficient. And I think that there's some truth to that, but the other side of that question is a very basic principle of American local government law, is that bodies that tax, particularly that have hundreds of millions of dollars of taxing authority and very significant spending authority, it's been the practice in the United States, almost without exception, to make them directly elected and accountable to the people. You could say all these same things about cities or counties. Now, the Metropolitan Council is a very much more significant authority than most planning agencies. Most metropolitan planning organizations have a budget of $50 million or so and just do transportation planning for freeways. This body has a budget of $650 million and has huge capital costs and built sewers and freeways and has a very large authority to shape the future of the metropolitan area in a discretionary way. So this is, I think.
Senator Roebling, and then I would like to hear other testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Orfield, but doesn't the legislature have authority over the Met Council and their bonding limits? We basically tell them you can bond for transportation and or transit and you can go up to this limit. Do we not set that ourselves?
Professor Orfield?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, very much in the same way that the legislature has control over the bonding authority of a large municipality or a county. All local governments are creatures of state law. The state has absolute supremacy over defining these boundaries and responsibilities. No power to tax that a local government has exists without the express provision of it. There's no inherent authority of any local government to tax or spend. They're all provided by the legislature, and this is very parallel to this. It's very much like a city or a county. The legislature creates the power, as it does for Hennepin County, as it does for the city, and it can take it back. It's very, very similar.
I'll hold my question.
Beg pardon?
I'll hold my question.
Thank you. We have other people who wanted to testify who are on our list, Ms. Gleason from Isaiah and Russ Adams for the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability. However, we also want to hear from Mr. Weaver, who was not able to be at the last meeting, and Mr. Bell is not able to be here today either to speak in opposition to the bill. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much for the chance to.
And I would ask both Ms. Gleason and Mr. Adams to come forward.
Very briefly.
And please limit your comments, if you will, to we have a number of other bills to get to. If you could limit your comments to a very little.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I get the hint. My name is Russ Adams. I'm with the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability. I would just make two or three points on why we think this bill is a good one. It does add another layer of accountability. The Met Council signs off on massive public investments, water and sewer, roads, transportation infrastructure, and coordinates with local governments around tax abatements and other public subsidies that drive development. These decisions need to be transparent and accountable to the local voters. The other issue that it raises, I think, is independence of individual Met Council members. To date, they serve at the pleasure of the governor, and we've seen many examples of Met Council members looking over their back in terms of making individual decisions on issues that come before them, knowing that there is an ultimate authority they answer to, and it's not local voters. And then finally, I'll just point out that we're not alone in terms of organizations that are in favor of an elected Met Council. The Citizens League, which is a storied body, a very reputable organization that 40 years ago helped to hatch the concept of a Met Council, in a report in July of 97 recommended that the Met Council be elected. So there is a very large level of interest among citizens and organizations on this. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair. Ms. Gleason.
Sask, our testifier, it's the Alliance for Metropolitan Stability. Who are members of the alliance? I'm not familiar with it.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it's a coalition of environmental, faith-based, community-based organizations. There's about 20 organizations, so I can give you a brochure that lists them if you'd like rather than take up the committee time. But groups like the Sierra Club, the Minneapolis Urban League, the League of Women Voters.
Thank you. Ms. Gleason?
Madam Chair, Senators, my name's Sarah Gleason. I'm a leader with ISAIAH, and I did speak for a few minutes to the subcommittee, so I'll keep it short. ISAIAH is a coalition of 80-some congregations, mostly churches, in the metro area and in the St. Cloud area. And I'm a member of the Metropolitan Equity Committee there, where we work on issues that often involve the Met Council. And we're very proud that this metropolitan region has such a thing as a Met Council that really does take the region into account as a community and have some vision and long-term thought about that. The kind of relationship we'd like to be in with them is one where we can be really co-creators of our shared future. And we believe that we're best able to create that kind of a give-and-take, mutual accountability kind of relationship is if those folks are elected. So we are in favor of elected Met Council.
Thank you. Mr. Weaver. And again, it really does, we really do want to respect the work and the testimony, et cetera, given in the subcommittees when the bills come to the the full committee, and really should only be hearing from new people and or if there is additional information. Mr. Weaver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tom Weaver, the Regional Administrator at the Metropolitan Council, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here today. As I'm sure you're aware, Chairman Bell really would have liked to have been here. I know you rescheduled this once already to accommodate him when he was in Washington. And we know you need to keep things moving along, but his not being here should not be seen as a lack of his interest in this bill.
Obviously. No, we don't take it that way.
Okay. As you have heard, this bill's been, or this concept has been kicked around for 40 years since the time the council was first created, and there are certainly a lot of good arguments for it, and there are good arguments against it. We think the stronger arguments favor keeping the body the way it is as an appointed body. The first reason is an elected council would invariably become much more independent, and some would argue more powerful.
Excuse me, Mr. Weaver, is this sound out from you?
Yes.
Okay, there's not a name on it, even though it said Met Council at the top. I just want to make sure that
I apologize,
people know that.
Madam Chair.
This is from Mr. Weaver.
Okay.
Go ahead.
As has already been pointed out, the districts, Met Council districts, would be more than twice the size of current Senate districts, more than four times the size of House districts. Those districts would dwarf the size of most of the communities that the council works with. And as currently constituted, our council, we believe, shows an appropriate amount of deference to local elected officials out of respect for the fact that they're elected and the Met Council is not. And I think that's evidenced, probably the best example is Lake Elmo. The Metropolitan Council won several court battles and had the authority given by the courts to go in and impose our plan on the city of Lake Elmo, but again, out of respect for the fact that they are elected officials. The Met Council is not. We thought the more prudent course was to negotiate a resolution of those issues with the city of Lake Elmo that they could live with and that the Met Council could live with. Second, I don't think there's any question that an elected council would be much more parochial. The whole purpose for having a Metropolitan Council is to ensure efficient planning and use of regional infrastructure that crosses municipal boundaries. Sewers, transportation, and parks are the systems we're most concerned with, and that requires that council members bring a regional perspective to the table. Elected members would have a vested interest in doing what's best for their respective districts, jeopardizing their regional perspective. Elected members would be under pressure to bring home a park or a transit stop or a livable communities grant rather than looking out for what's in the best interest of the region as a whole. We also believe this legislation could undermine the partnerships that the council has built for carrying out its responsibilities. In particular, we collaborate with 189 communities on comprehensive planning. Again, we show a lot of deference to those communities and work with them to try to resolve comprehensive planning issues in a way that that serves our interests but is respectful of the fact that they are elected. In the area of transportation and transit planning, it becomes more complicated. The Hiawatha Light Rail Line, the North Star Commuter Rail Line, the Central Corridor, all major transit projects that could not be delivered without a very close working relationship between the Metropolitan Council and MnDOT, along with several other partners. Being part of the administration, along with MnDOT, certainly facilitates our partnership with MnDOT on these projects and ensures that we're pulling in the same direction with them. If the council were elected, how do you ensure that this essential partnership will continue? What if, for example, the administration supported a project and the elected Met Council did not, or vice versa? What kind of gridlock might that create on these very important transit projects? Similarly, the Met Council is responsible for preparing and submitting the Transportation Policy Plan, the TPP, every few years. The TAB, and let me explain briefly, the TAB is a Transportation Advisory Board made up of 33 members. 17 of them are elected. We channel funds. They make decisions on how federal funds are distributed. That's what allows the Met Council to be the MPO that Professor Orfield was referring to. We have this TAB in place that has 17 local elected officials on it.
For these reasons, I think.
So, again, it's very important for the council in working with our partners to have this kind of relationship. This TAB, the Metropolitan Planning Organization for this region, again, that's where our federal funds flow. They either flow through MnDOT or from the Met Council, and it's created by the governor and elected officials representing at least 75% of the metropolitan area. Since MPOs have elected representation, we've established the Transportation Advisory Board. Again, 33 members, 17 elected. If the council were elected, we're concerned that there could be two negative consequences of that. Number one is the Metropolitan Council could continue to be the MPO, and the TAB could be eliminated. In that case, that local government representation on the TAB and their role in determining how those federal funds are spent would be eliminated. Another negative consequence could be that the Met Council might lose its MPO designation. Then it could no longer be the grant recipient for projects like Central Corridor. As I'm sure you're aware, the Met Council is currently the lead agency on the Central Corridor and will be the grant recipient receiving the funds for that transit project. In addition, under this bill, our region would be changing to an elected council at a very critical juncture, as Senator Pappas indicated. We recently were authorized to go into preliminary engineering. That's about a two-year process on the Central Corridor. So in about 2 years, we'll be asking the FTA to allow us to go into final design. At that time, the FTA does an extensive review. The Federal Transit Administration does an extensive review on the governance structure, the management organization, budget, and finances. They expect all those decisions to be made and the project to be firmed up with regard to those components. The prospect of an elected Met Council in 2008 may be cause for FTA to aggressively question whether we really have our ducks in a row for that project. Again, it comes at a critical time in the Central Corridor planning process. And there's no secret that there's way too many New Starts projects and not nearly enough funding for those projects. And in working with the FTA on Central Corridor and the North Star project, I think it's fair to say that they are looking for any excuse to delay or disqualify projects so they can fund others. and a delay, a one-year delay in Central Corridor will cost the project about $35 million, money that the project cannot afford to lose. Coincidentally, right now in the state of Utah, the legislature is considering a bill to dissolve the Utah Transit Authority and shift its responsibilities to the Utah Department of Transportation. Transit officials there have similarly warned that such a governance change at this juncture could mean costly delays for light rail and commuter rail in the Salt Lake City area. Fourth, an elected council may not be as balanced, diverse, as the current appointed council is. Obviously, the governor has the ability to ensure that council members include experience with local government, business, and law, some of the things that are helpful to the council. He can assure that it includes members with historical knowledge of the region. He can provide for racial and gender balance on the council. Elections would obviously leave that type of balance and diversity to chance. Under our present elected Met Council,
yes. I take exception to that. They would leave them to the voters, not to chance.
Madam Chair, perhaps chance was not the best choice of words for that concept, but you get my drift. Under our present system, the Metropolitan Council is accountable to both the governor and the legislature, as has been pointed out. The council chair and its 16 members are appointed by and serve at the pleasure of the governor. They are all subject to Senate confirmation. They also go through kind of an unusual appointments process. These are the only gubernatorial appointments that have to go through a selection committee and public hearings before the governor makes appointments. The council chair is a member of the governor's cabinet and is accountable to him just like every other state commissioner. The council's budget appropriations and bonding requests are reviewed annually by multiple committees in both the House and the Senate. So we think there is plenty of accountability on behalf of the council. With respect to our taxing authority, we do have a budget of $665 million for 2007. Most of that revenue comes from user charges, passenger fares, and state appropriations that the legislature must approve. Only 10% of that comes from local property taxes, so the majority of our budget does not come from those taxes. I don't want to minimize that. It's still a lot of money, but we think there's plenty of accountability in place. The current council has kept our property taxes flat, by the way, for the past 4 years. We have not increased our property taxes. We've also maintained our AAA bond rating along the way. In terms of outreach and working with local communities and constituents, we meet regularly with AMM, the county boards, the seven metro counties, and county commissioners from the adjacent counties. Over the last several years, we've prepared our 2030 regional framework after having 16 public outreach meetings around the metro area. Last year, we conducted 16 planning workshops attended by over 500 local officials, planners, and consultants, preparing them for updating their comprehensive plans. In addition, we have public hearings every time we change transit fares or make a major change to transit routes, adjust our sewer services, amend system plans, or propose interceptor projects. We have public hearings all the time, so we think that there is a pretty incredible amount of outreach that the council does, in fact, do. And we think these efforts are paying off. Our 2006 survey of metro area residents showed that 42% of residents rated the council's performance as good or very good, which is the highest rating the council's got in the last 10 years that we've been doing the survey. So in conclusion, I'd just like to state that we are concerned that an elected Met Council would be more independent and more powerful. It would be less deferential to local units of government. It would be more parochial, and that this legislation could jeopardize important partnerships inherent in the council's business, the region's ability to leverage federal funds for transportation projects and transitway projects for which the council is responsible, most notably the Central Corridor LRT line. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd just like to conclude by saying that we certainly appreciate all the support that the council's received from Senator Uyghur over the years, and we do disagree with him on this bill, although we do kind of like the staggered council concept. So with that, I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Uyghur. Mr. Weaver, I think we'll hear from the there are two other people that wanted to testify against the bill, and we'll hear from them, and then if there are comments to either of you, any of you, we'll or two other people who want to testify on the bill. I'm not going to presume that they're in opposition to it. Mr. Jamboys first. And then Mr. Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Louis Jamboy. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. Mr. Weaver referred to us as AMM a few moments ago. That's who we have been. We've started calling ourselves Metro Cities. We think it's a little more descriptive. We are here to testify on the bill. We're not here to testify in favor or in opposition.
Sorry, I didn't mean to mischaracterize your testimony.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. We have 86 members in the seven-county metropolitan area, cities of various shapes and sizes. It includes the core cities, the inner-ring suburbs, the developing cities, and the developing fringe. We were created in 1974 to deal with issues that are associated with the Twin Cities metropolitan area, particularly the Met Council, and here at the legislature on issues that have metropolitan significance. Since that time, since the creation of our organization, there's been ongoing debate about this issue, about whether or not there should or shouldn't be an elected Met Council, and our organization's gone back and forth more than once. The last time that our organization took a really, really serious look at the issue was in 1999. That precedes my time, so we went back and did a little homework, and it looked to us like the organization was split. There was a lot of passion, but there wasn't consensus. And as a result, the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities has a neutral position on the election of the Met Council. I've been around for a couple years now. We have 60-plus policy positions. The selection of the Met Council is one of those. It didn't get a real serious discussion in the last two go-arounds with our policy committees, but there is one area that we're fairly adamant about, and that is that we believe the council should serve fixed staggered terms. We think that a planning organization and a facility management organization needs some continuity at the decision making as well as the staff level. We know that the staff is a long-term, very professional, very qualified staff, but we believe that there should be some institutional knowledge at the decision making positions as well. We also think that fixed staggered terms could theoretically, at any rate, moderate dramatic political swings in our state and in the metropolitan area. And as a result, we would recommend a serious consideration of at least the term section in this bill. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll quit.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jamboy. Mr. Flores. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We would, since this bill did get a full hearing in the subcommittee, we would ask you to be extremely brief.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Jason Flores. I'm here today representing the Metropolitan Coalition of Chambers of Commerce. That's a association representing business in more than 60 communities, 25 metro area chambers. It was formed 5 years ago as an advocate for significant investment and improvement in the Twin Cities transportation infrastructure. I'll make my comments brief, as I do think these concerns are best addressed in the Transportation Committee. MCC has worked primarily on funding issues here at the legislature, but we have also monitored regional governance issues as they relate to transportation. We have, since our formation, advocated for better coordination and integration of transportation projects in the metro area. We fully support the current plan as presented by the Met Council. We do have concerns, however, with this proposal, and many of them do echo points made previously by Mr. Weaver. First, we support increased coordination and cooperation in transportation, but believe that this bill would only add yet another level of complexity and compound already competing interests. Currently, the council works very well with local officials, but if elected, could lead to unnecessary political tensions that could interfere with long-term planning efforts. Secondly, the current structure of the Met Council already allows for political responsiveness and accountability without directly exposing council members to the pressures of electoral politics. We've experienced recently the difficulty in addressing transportation funding needs through the political process. Meanwhile, development of long-term strategic planning has moved forward with wide approval of the results. In conclusion, Madam Chair, we have serious concerns with Senator Wieger's bill and believe the current Metropolitan Council appointment system does serve the region very well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flores. Are there others who would like to speak on this bill in the public? Senator Roebling, but I hope that we can move on this bill. We do have four other bills, and some people have time constraints.
Thank you, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I just wanted to point out that Jim Solem, the
yes,
former regional
you.
Administrator of the Metropolitan Council, has a memo in our packet, and he is not any longer connected with the Metropolitan Council, and he is not supporting an elected Met Council. And if you want to read through that, he very clearly points out why he does not support an elected Met Council at this time.
Yes. Thank you, Senator Roebling. I think a number of us have heard from Mr. Solem, and we were pleased to put his comments in the folder since he couldn't be here today. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I've been a supporter of an elected Met Council for over 20 years. Shows how long we've been around here.
Yes.
And I've often wondered if this wasn't and kind of an improper delegation of legislative authority, and that if somebody ever wanted to challenge it constitutionally, if they couldn't do that, because we really should not. On the other hand, because they're governor appointees, it probably isn't. It's not like a private entity. It's still a public entity. But I'm very sympathetic to Professor Orfield's argument that this should be an elected body. However, I have to apologize to Senator Wieger. Until we have an answer from the federal authorities on if this would have a negative impact on our major transit projects, I just don't feel comfortable voting for it. So, I mean, I'd be happy to vote to lay it over until we could get more answers, but if we don't lay it over, then I'm afraid I'm going to have to vote no.
Is there further discussion?
Well, Madam Chair, I believe the Senate Transportation Committee requested review. There could be a chance. And Senator Pappas, look at the organizations that testified for this. Do you have any doubt that ISAIAH is for the Central Corridor, for North Star? Do you have any doubt where Alliance for Metro Stability weighs in on this?
Madam
please
Chair.
Let Senate Transportation Committee get further input on that unless you want to kill it.
Senator Pat.
Madam Chair and Senator Wieger, but all of us who have good intentions, who want both the Central Corridor and want an elected Met Council, we don't quite understand how the federal bureaucracy works. And maybe they will like it, as Professor Orfield argued, because they have to have a tab in order to be in compliance with federal law. But maybe they won't like it because of the insecurity in changing the governance structure and until things kind of settle down. And I just really am nervous about any delay in what we're trying to accomplish here in terms of transit, both in terms of cost, in terms of, you know, federal priorities. If we look like we're in disarray on a local level, on a state level, there's plenty of other metropolitan areas that will take the transit money for light rail. So I'm just too nervous about this moving forward. And, you know, that's why I would be happy to move to lay over the bill until we can get more answers. But I do feel like we are the Metropolitan Committee. We're providing the oversight for the Metropolitan Committee, and it's really us who should decide about the elected council. I can understand why these other committees are nervous for their little piece, but really it's up to us to decide on the governance. And Madam Chair, Senator Wieger, I mean, I'm happy to make the motion.
Senator Pappas, before you do that, there is a technical amendment that whatever happens needs to be added to this bill. And Senator Larson moves the A4 amendment. and Mr. Senator Larson, do you know what the amendment is? How it's technical?
I believe it is technical, and I would defer to Mr. Watson because it's been some time since we've discussed this.
The A4 amendment.
Madam Chair, what the A4 amendment does is just delay the effective date of the repealer of the subdivision that sets forth the current council districts until after the council has a chance to draw its new districts in the year 2012. Otherwise, the repealer would be effective in 2008.
Everybody understand the amendment? It just makes the bill consistent. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. We have Senate File 81 in before us. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, and Senator Wigger, Madam Chair is a co-author on the bill. So she can, if I move to lay it over and that prevails, she could bring it back at any time if she feels like there's enough support in the committee. So I don't feel like I'm killing the bill, but I do feel like after all these years, I mean, I was somewhat sympathetic to Mr. Solon's argument that maybe this is a solution that was appropriate 10 years ago and no longer is. I'm not really dissatisfied with the Met Council. I'm hearing that things are going well. And if that's not true, I'd like to hear from transit advocates and from Isaiah that there are problems that this will solve, that an elected Met Council will solve. So, Madam Chair, I just move that we... That Senate File 81, is that what it is?
Yes.
Senate File 81 be laid over.
That motion is non-debatable. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, say no.
No.
No. Chair's in doubt. Those who support Senator Pappas's motion, please raise your hand. Those who oppose her motion, raise your hand. There being four ayes and five noes, the motion does not prevail. Senator Larson.
I move the bill, Madam Chair, and move that Senate File 81 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Transportation Committee.
As amended. You've heard Senator Larson's motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The ayes have it, and the motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Wigger.
Madam Chair.
I'm going to...
Division? Here we go. I was just asking for a division, Madam Chair.
We'll go back. All those in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed, please raise your hand. The chair's hearing was correct, and the motion does prevail, and the bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Wigger. A couple of these bills can be dealt with very quickly, but Senator Dahl does have an obligation that would cause him to leave. I think his bill will take about 2 minutes. So we're going to go out of order, Senator Cohen, and we'll get to your bill really quickly, but we're going to take up Senate File 483. Senator Larson, for a motion, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move adoption of the subcommittee report on Senate File 483.
Senator Larson moves adoption of the subcommittee report on Senate File 483. Everyone in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. We now have Senate File 483 in front of the committee, and it's a very straightforward bill. Senator Dahl, if you would explain it. I think we can deal with it very quickly.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. It's kind of like deja vu. I think most of you heard this last week, but Senate File 483 repeals the language in a Minnesota statute, Section 204D.1, and it was deemed unconstitutional in 2004 by the Minnesota Supreme Court. In that case, it was a case regarding Independence Party candidates Moore versus Kiffmeyer. And the Supreme Court found that there was an irrationality and arbitrariness to the primary threshold law. And first of all, there was a different primary vote threshold applicable to the different parties, and the result was that the Independence Party candidates, which demonstrated more voter support than the Green Party, were nevertheless denied access to the general election ballot. The primary threshold law states that you need to have 10%, one candidate at least, of your party, major party, in the last general election needs to capture at least 10% of the average of the votes of all the candidates running in that particular district. And due to the arbitrariness of the law, they found that was, again, unconstitutional. It violated the First and the 14th Amendments. And they sided with the plaintiffs in that case. I would like to see that the bill, this bill will repeal that unconstitutional language, and take any questions if you have them at this time.
Questions? Is there anybody who would like to testify on this bill that has not done so previously? Senator Larson for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 483 be recommended to pass.
Senator Larson moves that Senate File 483. How was it?
Subcommittee report.
Okay. We had adopted the subcommittee report. That's Senate File 483 is meant to be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank
Senator
you, Madam
Cohen.
Chair, members.
Senator Cohen. Senator Cohen, welcome to the committee. And we are here to take up Senate File 263. We are interested. 265, sorry. And we are interested in the Section 3 of the bill. And I have, I guess, Sections 3, 4, and 5. Sections 3 and 4. And I have indicated to you some concerns I had. I've also expressed them to President Brunix, and I will have an amendment for you to consider that will address my concerns. But Senator Cohen, if you'd like to give us a brief description of the bill, but then particularly we're looking at the establishment of the authority as the purview of this committee. And because it does have legislators on it, it will be directed to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm just going to be fairly brief because I know you still have other bills on your agenda.
Yes, I do.
And I know President Brunix has else he has to go. So I'll let the President do most of the talking. Members who served in the Senate last year might recall that we heard this bill on the Senate floor, and it passed by a vote of, I want to say, something like 50 to 12 or something. It was
51 to 15.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, President. 51 to 15. I'm corrected. So I was close, but so it had some significant support in last year's Senate. And what the bill does is that it establishes the authority to allow the university to plan ahead for the construction of several biomedical facilities. The general purpose in what is intended is that the university has been operating at a significant disadvantage relative to other major research universities throughout the country. And I think most of us at one time or another have heard the discussion that if the University of Minnesota is going to move forward and it's going to be the institution that, on a comparative basis, it was two or three decades ago, it needs to be brought up in comparison to the other comparable universities and to allow for the construction of these biomedical facilities in a way that would allow them to plan ahead, to engage staff, to make funding decisions, and to make sure that we're doing this in a way that the university will be competitive not 100 years from now, but over the next 10 years. Certainly, it's no secret to anybody on this committee that the intersection between Minnesota's economy and the university's biomedical research mission over the last number of years has been significant. A common example has been the operation and initiation of Medtronic, which developed because of the university's research mission. If we're going to develop the next Medtronic, and whatever the particular issue is or the particular research avenue will be, it's going to be because the university has brought itself up to where it was X number of years ago. This is the legislation that does this, and I think the president can maybe indicate that this is arguably the university's major legislative initiative of the last several years, and I think what's anticipated over the next number of years in terms of what will make a difference for the university and consequently the state of Minnesota. Now, Madam Chair, then, I know, again, as you've mentioned, the interest in this committee will be the establishment of the authority.
That's correct.
The construction of the authority, the insurance that the chair is looking for in terms of some of the appointment of the authority, mm-hmm. how the authority starts up, what the membership is, and so on. And although I haven't seen your particular amendment, it's been described to me, and as best I know, that would be a great supplement to this legislation. But maybe in the interest of time, I could have President Brunix talk in a general way about what's intended, and then we could discuss the particular concerns you have in terms of the authority itself.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. President Brunix, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll try to be very brief because I know your time is really short, and one could spend a lot of time talking about this particular issue. I think Senator Cohen has done an excellent job in framing the issues for you. This bill, as he said, was heard and received very, very strong bipartisan support in the last Senate session, and we had very promising hearings in the House as well, but we didn't get it passed in the House. I think this is not only a critically important bill for the future of the University of Minnesota and the research that we do on behalf of our state, but I absolutely believe this is critical to the future of the state's economy. And let me just make a couple of very quick comments, and then we'll talk a little bit about the authority and what is proposed. We're already one of the leading research universities in the United States, if not the world, when it comes to biomedical research, medical devices, and our connection to the health industries of Minnesota. This is a state with more than 500 medical devices and medical firms in Minnesota. They employ 250,000 people. In the past 10 years, the employment growth in this sector has been close to 31% compared to a 10% national average. And it is a very big part of Minnesota's economy. You know all the leading companies, Boston Scientific, we mentioned Medtronic, but there are so many other small thriving companies like Sermonix and many others that could be mentioned that are a very big part of the economic fabric and the growth potential of Minnesota. Our university receives about 98% of all the funded research that comes into institutions of higher education in Minnesota. We expect that will be approximately $600 million this year. It has a tremendous spinoff impact on Minnesota's economy and quality of life. I modeled one day what would happen if this amount of funding were to decline by $100 million, roughly 17%, which is not impossible in this hyper-competitive world. And it would cost the state $150 million in the private economy every year. It would cost 3,000 jobs in the private economy every year, and it would cost a significant reduction in our competitive position if you think about the impact of new discoveries and the transfer of those discoveries into the marketplace of Minnesota and beyond. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this slide, but one of our vice presidents, Tim Mulcahy, who's vice president for research, used this great little expression you see on your rearview mirror, particularly on the passenger side. He said the image in your rearview mirror could be closer than you think. And I think it's a good metaphor for the kind of situation we find ourselves in. There are about 30 states across the United States now that are making very, very profound investments in this area. You all know about the stem cell initiative in California. You know, and that's $300 billion of capital and programmatic investment. But there are many, many other states that are making much more significant investments in this area. And they're trying to build what Minnesota already has. They're trying to build the capacity in their research universities, and they're trying to build the capacity that you find currently in Minnesota today. And some of these examples are up there on the screen. The numbers in parentheses reflect the funding position of these public research universities with respect to the NSF rankings for funding. The University of Minnesota is usually in the eighth position in these national rankings and compares quite well. So what do we need to stay competitive? I think Senator Cohen has put it quite well. You can't compete today without the facilities and without the laboratories. And the science is moving so quickly, so rapidly in this area, that it requires the kind of infusion of capital and the long-term sustained planning that we're asking for in this Biomedical Science Research Authority. If we were to try to accomplish the same thing in the regular capital budget process of the state, I suspect we would not get there. In 2008, I must tell you, I can't bring one of these biomedical sciences buildings forward. It would take 60% of our capital budget. It has taken 60% of the last two capital budgets to make critical investments in this area. And to do so, again, would ignore some absolutely critical and, I think, pressing academic needs that have something to do with the 28 million assignable square feet that we manage throughout the state of Minnesota for all types of purposes. So you need a long-term horizon here. The funding would be every 2 years. We proposed it be in the odd years, as you'll see in just a moment. I would say that the university's strategic planning, its internal reallocation of resources, the biennial budget that you have before you is all lined up with the plans and priorities that you see in the Biomedical Sciences Facilities Authority. I'd like Fitz now to take my chair for just a moment. That is Richard Fitzenreiter, our Vice President for Finance, and he can lay out the financial framework and the model that we're proposing in this legislation.
Thank you, President Bernanke. Mr. Fitzenreiter, could identify yourself, please, for the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Fitzenreiter. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at the University of Minnesota. I'll do this very quickly because I know you want to get to your amendments. But what this bill does, it establishes a process to expend $279 million worth of state general obligation bonds. It requires the university to provide a 10% match, roughly $31 million. The creation of this authority is a unique request on the part of the University of Minnesota. We know that it is not the typical way that bonding projects occur in the legislative process. As the president mentioned earlier, our ability to plan in a thoughtful and predictable way and recruit is why we came up with this concept. The authority was created because we felt a strong commitment to having the process be transparent and that we were accountable. We could have and certainly thought of the idea, well, let's just come and ask for the money and go away and build these projects. But we thought that it was important because it's unique. It's asking for you to bless an authority, a bonding amount well into the future, that we felt an authority in between us and the legislative process would be good from the standpoint of transparency and accountability. So the authority in legislation has particular responsibilities. It's a 13-member. There are non-voting members as well. They are charged with accepting applications for these projects. There's a timeline regarding the amount outstanding. If you flip to the next slide, there's a specific timing to when the authority can authorize bonds. There's a requirement that we submit an application. There's criteria. And frankly, as we do one of these buildings and come back, we certainly expect to have the authority ask us questions. Well, what did you accomplish with the last project? And that's part of the accountability framework that's embedded in the authority. That's a very quick recap of what this authority is about and why we have it in the legislation, and I'll turn back to the president to wrap it up.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald.
Let me just make a couple of chair members of the committee, just a few additional comments. You see on this chart the proposed schedule, which would be about every 2 years, and at least the anticipated amounts of these significant projects. I think it's reasonable to ask why this mechanism, and there are a lot of reasons, but I think Senator Cohen indicated that one of them has to do with the accelerating nature of research and technology transfer in this area and the importance of taking a long-term view and taking a sustained view of what is necessary to keep the university competitive and to keep the kind of technology transfer as strong as it possibly can be in Minnesota. For example, the University of Minnesota today on a competitive basis has been independently ranked as having the fourth most promising technology transfer pipeline. And I think you can't have that kind of pipeline unless you make the investment in people and the facilities that are necessary to support them. You might ask what's going to go on in these buildings. There are some very interesting stories that one could tell you about each of these lines. But, for example, the 717 Delaware building is the old Department of Health building, very, very close to the location of the hospital on the Twin Cities campus. And it's going to deal with a wide range of clinical trials related to diseases such as hypertension, heart disease, diabetes, AIDS, smoking and other addictions, stroke, obesity. It'll be the location of what we call a BSL-3 laboratory that will do leading-edge research on infectious diseases, in diseases such as West Nile, influenza, tuberculosis. It'll be the Center for Neurobehavioral Development, and they're going to be looking at issues related to the illnesses of the brain. It's part of the Translational Neuroscience Initiative of the University of Minnesota, a very big part of the medical school future. There'll be a lot of neuroscience work done in this particular facility. The number two line on this chart deals with the magnetic resonance research facility at the University of Minnesota. It is the leading center for research on imaging in the entire country, one of the strongest center of its kind, and it's absolutely foundational to all the work that you do in diagnosing disease, treating disease, studying the evolution and development of the human brain, the decline of neural functioning, and all the other things that you know are a part of the rapidly growing field of neuroimaging. Let me just make a couple of points. I like to use the quote from Will Rogers that goes something like this: even if you think you're on the right path, you can get run over if you just sit there. I think this is a time when Minnesota has to move, and I think this is an idea that I think is absolutely essential to our future. So I believe we are a national leader. We have been a national leader in this area. It's paid off in growing Minnesota's economy and quality of life. But if we don't invest, and we don't invest in a sustained way, this is an area of our economy and our comparative advantage that could slip rather quickly. I want to share, just close with a quick conversation I had with someone who is the director of research for one of the leading medical device companies in Minnesota. He told me he was going to build a research facility in Shanghai that would specialize in chemical engineering and material science. The University of Minnesota happens to have either the best or the second best department of chemical engineering and material science in the entire country. When I travel to China, the people in China want to know about this department. They want to build partnerships with it. But it's just one of those examples where if you don't locate the research laboratories in a state and build these kind of flourishing partnerships, the world is indeed flat, as Tom Friedman says, and you can export those laboratories to many other parts of the world. So I want to urge the committee and the Senate again to do what it did in its wisdom last year and pass this bill overwhelmingly and pass it on a strong bipartisan vote. So that ends my quick summary of this bill along with my colleagues, and we'd be glad to take your questions and comments.
Thank you, President Brunix. Are there comments or questions for President Brunix? Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen and President, I support this 100%. Always have it. I like that statement up there. I'm trying to get a little money for the city of Worthington, who has a bioscience, biotechnology operation. It's small scale compared to this, but it would create 400 jobs. It would train lab technicians. They get enough salary so they'd stay in rural Minnesota instead of moving off. So I just say, as we go through this process, I'm going to be working with you, and I put in a bill already to see how that goes. But that's right. I like that statement. Good for the university, but there's another part. And they hook up with Minnesota West, that campus down there. Mm-hmm. So we'll be talking to it about it. But I'm going to vote this, and I think it's a wonderful idea. We just need to move on. And hurry up and get that stadium. I'm supposed to get over there and watch the ball.
It won't be long.
I'm still waiting.
Thank you, Senator Rickerman. Are there any other questions or comments for President Brunix?
Not for President Brunix, for Senator Cohen.
Then thank you very much, President Brunix. Senator Roebling, you have a question for Senator Cohen, and then we do have some amendments.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Cohen, and I know because you deal with all of the fiscal issues, this is just kind of a technical question I'm trying to get full clarity on. If we do this and we have our state statute that says we can only we put our own cap on how much we can bond for with general obligation bonds, and we do that partly because we want to retain our AAA rating. How does this play in that mix? I just don't understand how can this be outside of that, or is it inside of it? I'm just trying to understand that.
Senator Cohen.
Sure, Senator Roebling. I'll answer a couple of different ways. There is a memo from the Department of Finance that suggests it might be inside of that 3%. There has been some discussion as to whether or not that would be the case. In any event, and it's not, obviously this is more within Senator Lanksa's purview than mine, as chairman of the Capital Investment Committee. Obviously, as that committee is working through any decisions it has, say in next year's bonding bill, a major bonding bill, it will take a look at the impact of this bill relative to that, but keep in mind this bill is spread out over a number of years, so it's not going to have an impact in totality, say in next year's bonding bill. Should also add, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I don't know if this gives you any reassurance. I'm not sure if Senator Lanksa, is he a co-author on the bill? I'm not sure that.
Yeah, he is.
He is. I don't have the authors in front of me. So the list.
Pappas, Lanksa, Senjum, Rosen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Would point out that obviously Senator Lanksa is the chair of the committee. Senator Pappas chairs the higher ed division. You serve on the higher ed division as well. And so the people who have been most involved with this are supporters and will make sure that this doesn't interfere to any extent unnecessary with what we're doing with bonding.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I'm going to limit my questions to the issues that are before this committee since we'll see it in finance later.
We have some amendments to deal with that, but go right ahead.
I did have a question about why former members of the legislature.
Senator Pappas, that is one of the amendments. If you, Senator Cohen, would you mind if I explain the amendment that I'd like to offer, and then that might give some comfort to questions that are raised by the composition of the authority and its duties, et cetera.
Madam Chair, as you're doing this, is it possible to get a copy of the amendment so I can follow
along with you? Yes, now we'll hand it out. It's the A1 amendment, and there's going to be an addition to it. When I reviewed this bill about a week ago, in my pursuit of these guidelines for bills that have councils and so forth in there, I had a number of questions, and the amendment calls for The current member of the legislature, the current members of the legislature who would be on this authority are non-voting. But then I also found it very curious that there would be former members would be appointed and they would be voting members. And so the amendment suggests that we just say that they be public members. And if the appointing authority wants to appoint former legislators, they're certainly free to do that. But that they would not be a they would not be designated as such, so that this particular authority is so top-heavy with legislators. In addition, Mr. Bodern has one small change in the A1 amendment, and then I'll speak to the rest of the part of it. Mr. Bodern.
Madam Chair, just a small correction so that this engrosses properly. On the amendment, looking at lines 2, 4, 6, and 8, member needs to be deleted from the new language in each instance, and that way the sentence in each instance will read one current member of the Senate and one public member appointed by the respective appointing authorities.
The same appointing authorities. And in this legislation, we had this discussion with the other bill. It does name the majority leader of the Senate rather than the subcommittee on committees as the appointing authority in the Senate. For the assuming that would be the majority party's member. Also, the bill did not speak to, and this will be something that we're adding that's not in this amendment, but I'll go ahead and explain it now as well. I believe it's going to be on page 3 after line 2. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Would you read that language?
On page 3, line 2, to clarify who the convening authority would be, you can add another sentence that would say, the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development shall convene the first meeting of the authority.
One of the things that I've noticed in a number of bills is that they set up task force and they don't talk about how to get them started. And so we would add that to the A1 amendment. Then in line 10 of the amendment, referencing page 2, line 33, Senator Cohen, there's a real issue about how you go about setting up staggered terms when there are multiple appointing authorities. And both Mr. Watson and Mr. Bodern met for 15, 20 minutes trying to figure out how to state that, and it didn't work. And so the amendment for those members just deletes the word staggered for the terms. It works for your language works for the gubernatorial appointments to be staggered, but not for appointees of more than one authority. So we just took that out just to clean it up. So that's my first amendment. Senator Cohen, do you have any response?
Madam Chair, I think the language you suggest certainly clarifies parts of the bill. Would have no objection. We'll just make a note that I think the reason for including former members of the legislature was to try to make sure there was significant legislative involvement. But I think under your language, if the majority leader or the speaker think it's important to have somebody who's a former member, that would fit the definition of public. They could do the same thing.
Absolutely. And if they did not feel that there was a former member who was qualified to bring that kind of oversight, then they would be free to choose someone else.
Nobody wanted to do it.
Is there any discussion of this amendment? It includes the language that you have on the A1 amendment, in addition to the small change that Mr. Bodern made and the additional comment about the convening authority. All those in favor of the A1 amendment as modified, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Cohen, I don't have an amendment for this, but in general, after a provision for an authority or a task force indicates that either a process or name someone to be chair. And I understood from President Brunix in a conversation before the meeting that in your bill last year, you had designated the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development as the chair. Is there some reason why you wanted to be silent on that? Because otherwise, there is no chair here.
Madam Chair, I think just in the redrafting, I'm not sure that there was a particular reason for the exclusion. It was just more a question of the redrafting and was omitted. So,
would you mind if we reinserted that just so that there's some, you know, lines of communication and authority here? Mr. Bodern, on line 219, could we just insert there the consists of the Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development who will serve as chair?
Madam Chair, that sounds fine.
Is there a discussion of that amendment? And chair of the authority.
I'll move that amendment.
Thank you, Senator Pappas. You've heard the amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. And then, Senator Cohen, I found it curious to have on lines, page 3, lines 3 through 5, to indicate what a quorum is. A quorum, unless it's something other than a majority of the members, is a majority. And so I would hold up to you that subdivision 2 is not necessary. It would only be necessary if there was an extraordinary request, an extraordinary requirement for a majority, for a quorum.
Madam Chair, I don't presume to be the expert on the convening of extra legislative bodies. I don't know if either Mr. Watson or Senator Betz, well, Senator Betz
well,
is kind of an
this
expert
is the
of the legislature.
Advice I got from Mr. Bodern,
Mr.
who
Bodern?
Is our counsel for this particular part of the committee.
I'm sorry, I just saw Mr. Watson sitting
yeah,
there.
I know. So. And he said that it wasn't necessary.
So I don't, but if Mr. Bodern has taken a look at what would be necessary or not, and that superfluous language, again, would have no objection.
Okay, then Senator Larson will move the deletion of subdivision 2, lines 3 through 5. Then this is maybe not quite as transparent, I think, as that one, but I was curious about – I'm sorry. Senator Larson moved that. All those in favor of deleting subdivision 2 on page 3, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Just so there's no misunderstanding. The only reason I mentioned Mr. Watson is since he's counsel to the Rules Committee. So
I understand. And they work together.
I understand that.
Then Senator Cohen, subdivision 5 at the end of the page. Why did you find it necessary to indicate the personal liability language there? We found that very curious as well. That's I don't know for a task force authority, and I realize that that this is a rather unusual, if not unique, group that you're setting up, but that also is assumed, and you have stated in lines 3-2 that members of the authority are public officials for the for purposes of 10A, but that they are that they are public officials. Do you really need that section as well?
Well, again, Madam Chair, I defer to counsel. I know we have the statutory provision that allows for the exemption of liability in service on nonprofit boards. Because this is a hybrid, I think the thought was that maybe that would provide the clarification. But again, if counsel thinks that, again, that's superfluous as well.
Mr. Bodern?
Madam Chair, I have discussed this as with Mr. Watson and Ms. Pontius as well in our office. And we've concluded it's basically superfluous. It's a generally held principle of law that members of an entity like this would be exempt from any personal responsibility for actions taken by the authority.
Okay.
I'm sure that'd be fine then.
Senator Larson, do you move then that subdivision 5, lines 3.33 to 3.34 be deleted?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
That's it.
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel, do you have?
I do have a technical question. On page 4, line 16, the authority shall report to the legislature by July 1st of each odd-numbered year the implementation of projects. Well, legislative session usually ends around May and will start at the early part of the following year. If the report is submitted by July 1st, there may be staff around here, but the report will sit here for a number of months before anybody's going to look at it. I would think that if it's going to be meaningful, it should be submitted maybe, you know, towards the in say January or so that, you know, if it's something that people want to look at, but I don't know what July 1st does.
Senator Cohen, on the date.
I'm sure there's no strong feeling about that, and I recognize that we usually have
it's a fiscal
have the
year.
Reports by the first of the year, the calendar year, or something, December 15th or something. I think this was to match up with bonding cycles, but if we want to have it parallel to the other reports and make it January 1st, I think we've done some, December 15th, I think, so it was here by the start of the session. Senator Bessel, you had done that at one point.
Right. And Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, I mean, it's possible that the capital investment groups usually start going on their tours, you know, in the the odd-numbered year during the summer.
Right.
So it's possible that might, you know, the summer, fall. I'm not on it, but I'm assuming that it may tie into that. I'm just kind of curious as to if that's the purpose here. Because if that is, then that might make some sense where they would –
I'm sure Mr. Fitzenreiter indicates that was the reason was to match up with the tour cycle of the Capital Investment Committee.
I was curious. That would make some sense.
Senator Cohen, then I have one additional issue, and that is on the same page, but at the beginning of the page, Powers and Duties, where you do have this group adopting bylaws for its organization, but I question whether it is necessary for the commissioner to adopt rules governing the authority's operations, properties, and facilities, and wondered if you really wanted to do that. And I'll defer again to Mr. Bodden for where that might have come up before or otherwise.
Madam Chair and members, I'm unfamiliar with very many other instances where we have the commissioner overseeing a particular advisory group, or in this case, the authority providing rules for how they're going to conduct their business. It was just unclear to me in reviewing the bill what the necessity for that rulemaking authority would be. And this would be the commissioner of finance that's as defined in the bill.
Well, Madam Chair, with that explanation, if you want to remove lines 4.3 and 4.4, or that part of 4.3 after the period.
Senator Larson moves to delete everything after the period on line 4.3 and line 4.4. Is that clear to everyone? All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Anything else on this bill? Senator Gimsey.
Madam Chair, I was just looking at the A1 amendment, and it looks like we've eliminated one too many words. In the amendment, it says, and one former member. I don't believe that we should have probably taken out the word member.
Senator Gimsey, Mr. Bodden corrected that orally to catching the exact same thing that you are mentioning. So that was taken care of so that we did not take out a language we shouldn't have. Okay? Senator Cohen, I think this is an absolutely splendid project, and I'm looking forward to its success.
Appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Is there any further discussion? Is there anyone in the public that wants to testify either in favor or opposed to this bill? Sir, please come forward.
Thank you.
My name is Rick.
I will ask you to be brief. We do have a couple more bills to hear before 5:30.
Okay. My name is Rick Rotundo, and I'm the CEO of a small pharmaceutical engineering company. And first off, I'd like to say that I'm very proud that you're moving in the right direction with this bill. I would like to suggest, though, an amendment for under 514, where the agency, if you're a public or private institution, must be one that generates at least $75 million annually in federal competing funds. Well, if you're a small emerging biotech company with, for example, a highly innovative, in my case, it would be pharmaceutical, $75 million annually in federal grants precludes a small business. And, of course, the University of Minnesota being a land-grant institution, in its corporate charter is to foster the economic development of, at that time, originally it was corporations, and then, of course, the Minnesota Supreme Court upheld that there should be an emphasis on emerging corporations. So that's something I think the committee should take a very serious look at. And then the other thing that I think is extremely important is that with this kind of funding, it has a tremendous amount of power. And unless it is directed towards goal-specific objectives, you'll find results, as we have seen in other programs, where millions of dollars were put into a new building, new projects, new personnel, and nothing of any value to humanity or commercially or economically to Minnesota ever resulted from that. So I would suggest right in that same particular area, targeting towards small emerging companies that have validated a technology, whether it, for example, somewhere, some agency within the NIH that has a commercially viable technology to access this funding. If you don't do that, then how can a small emerging or startup corporation come up with a new product that could revolutionize a particular aspect of biotechnology without getting $75 million a year in grants?
Thank you. You know, the that part of the bill is under the funding program, and it is a it's not under the jurisdiction of this committee. So I would suggest that you have a conversation with Senator Cohen, and this bill has a couple more committees to go to, and it would be proper to bring it up at some other time.
Good.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, I was going to make the same comment. That, unfortunately, is one of the problems when we put bills on an agenda, and if you know all the interested parties who are here all the time have a sense of what the committee jurisdiction is, and I think it's unfortunately difficult for people who aren't here on an ongoing basis. But let me just suggest that subsequent to this committee, if the bill passes, this committee would ask that it be re-referred to, to my committee on finance. It'll be my intent.
Senator Cohen, any bill that has legislators on it goes to rules first.
Goes to rules before it goes to finance, or rules at the end of the road?
No, rules is next.
Okay, I'm sorry.
But it can go quickly there.
But I was going to just make it clear that when it gets to finance, would then go also to I would refer the bill to Senator Pappas's division, and there'd be the chance then in the higher education division to deal with the appropriate numbers and what should be encompassed within the bill.
Thank you, Senator Cohen, and perhaps.
Good. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Just really quickly, on this particular issue, but it has to do with whether or not that partnership has to be within the state of Minnesota. I'm wondering, it says at this rate, there's probably very few entities that would qualify, and especially in our state. So is this something that we want partnered within our state, or can this be anywhere? Doesn't say.
Sure. It would be within the state, is the intent. Mr. Sarah, okay. Vice President Sarah could talk in a little bit more detail about that if you'd like to hear from him at this point as opposed to Senator Pappas's division.
Oh, but that's fine. I'm just looking for a place where it states that. And so if it isn't in there, it should probably be addressed.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Senator Pappas. Moves.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, I would move that Senate File 265 be recommended to, as amended, be recommended to pass, and we refer to rules.
You've heard Senator Pappas's motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator
Chair members,
Cohen.
Thank you.
We have two other bills to finish before 5:30, our time of adjournment, and I think we'll be able to do that. And we're going to call, first of all, on Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair.
I have another amendment.
Senator Larson, your motion.
I would move adoption of the subcommittee report on Senate File 458.
Senator Larson moves adoption of the subcommittee report on Senate File 458. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. We have Senate File 458 before us. Senator Carlson, again, this bill had a full hearing in the subcommittee. If you would just briefly explain it, and you needn't go through all of the wonderful history of this issue, but just explain how your bill deals with trying to make disclaimers constitutional.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill that is attempting to correct some language in the disclaimer laws, and it has what it does is it replaces some past wording that has gone through several instances of court decisions, and what it does is it protects the rights of free speech and yet allows the people who are in our candidates and who are attempting to promote different ideas to promote their ideas and still report their expenditures. It enforces the requirement that anyone that's spending a significant sum has to report and disclose the collection and spending. It allows the persons that are being accused of bad conduct to confront their accusers. It gives voters information on the sources of information in campaign materials. And then finally, it allows those who do disseminate false information to be traced down and be held accountable. Section 1 adds the disclaimer law, and Section 2 makes the act effective the day following an enactment.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. The bill, as you see, came from the subcommittee without amendment, was fully explained at that time, and I appreciate your comments and summary now. Is there a discussion?
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Larson?
I move that Senate File 458 be recommended to pass.
Senator Larson moves that Senate File 458 be recommended to pass. Is there anyone who wanted to comment on this bill in the public? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Larson's motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank you very much, Senator Carlson, for
Thank
your
you,
patience.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas, Senator Madam Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move adoption of the subcommittee report for Senate File 226.
Senator Larson moves adoption of the subcommittee report on Senate File 226. As many who are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and we now report is adopted, and we now have Senate File 226 before us. That we did have, again, a lengthy discussion of this bill, made some very good amendments, and Senator Pappas, if you would explain the resolution that we came to.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. In current law, candidates have to be allowed into apartment buildings to campaign on a door-to-door basis, but I found during the last election that sometimes you're knocking on doors and you're registering voters, and sometimes you just want to remind people to vote, get out the vote, and you want to just leave a piece of literature at their door. And it didn't say in the law that you had to be allowed to leave a piece of literature at the door. So that's basically what we're expanding to say that we have to be allowed to do that. The Minnesota multi-housing folks asked if we could just say, could it be left in an orderly manner? And, of course, we all try to do that and not litter the hallways. Madam Chair, something else was brought to my attention, and that was the issue of nursing homes. And I think there's a distinction with nursing homes in that a nursing home, the door is more like a person's bedroom. It may not even be closed. And so I have an A4 amendment that would just say that if the manager of a nursing home prefers that the candidates not go door-to-door but leave campaign materials at a central location. And, of course, if they don't mind, and many nursing home residents would love to have visitors, and it's not a problem, but I did think that in that case we needed to have a little bit more respect for people's privacy.
Seems to be a very reasonable amendment. We'll wait until members have it distributed. Is there any discussion on Senator Pappas's amendment to Senate File 226? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 226 before us. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I'd move that Senate File 226 as amended be recommended to pass and recommended to pass.
Recommend to pass. And is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, we have the Pappas motion that Senate File 226 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Pappas. And members, good work. There being no further business before this committee, we stand adjourned. And